Diverse authorities have speculated. Why is it that the common mass of people so adore the rotten, the awful, the trite? In a remote laboratory, two genuine warlocks, Ben R. Williams and Greg Morrison, will look popular taste dead in the eye and hold a scalpel to its bloated gullet. They will read America's most popular books. They will ridicule the New York Times bestseller list. They will destroy their reputations and follow a terrible book even into a rotting grave. This, good people, is cannon fodder.
I'm not a man, I'm a destroyer. I'm not a man, I'm a destroyer.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am Ben R. Williams.
And I'm Greg Morrison.
And this is the first bonus episode of Cannon Fodder.
Inaugural special edition.
Yes, yes. Welcome indeed.
Yeah.
So I'll explain a little bit about what this is. We decided that occasionally, since it is often about 2 weeks between podcasts, that we might throw in a bonus episode about a number of sundry topics, but giving some special attention to books that we have read and actually enjoyed.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's the thing is, you know, we spend so much time talking about things that we just hate and find abominable. It might be kind of interesting to talk about some more obscure things and some things that we like but maybe you hadn't heard of, or just kind of present a softer and more tender side than the usual excoriating haters of popular literature that you encounter on this podcast.
Absolutely. And in this particular episode, we're going to be talking about Cows by Matthew Stokoe.
Yeah.
And we may parlay that into a discussion with a bit larger scope. We'll see where the recording process takes it.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll start out since I introduced you to this book, Greg.
Sure.
I'll explain how I came to be familiar with this book. I routinely read Rue Morgue magazine. Which is a horror magazine. It's sort of like a classy Fangoria.
Yeah, it's Playboy to Fangoria's Penthouse. You know,
that's exactly. I think we're well versed in pornography yeah. that we can, make statements like that. I mean, it's got kind of a Hustler vibe, but, you know, but it's far more readable than huge asses, comically huge asses. So. Where was it? Rue Morgue magazine. Yeah, it talks about. Think about porn. Rue Morgue magazine is a horror magazine that talks about horror films, but also literature, art, music, video games, everything horrifying you can imagine. If it's artistic, Rue Morgue will address it. And they had a great issue years ago, probably 4 or 5 years ago now, that contained a list of the 50 greatest alternative horror novels of all time.
Hmm.
And I read this list, and I sort of used it as a checklist. I decided I would try to read every book on it.
Right.
I have not quite done that yet. I've probably read about half of it. Discovered some great books through doing that, such as Dark Gods by T.E.D. Klein, which is one of the finest horror novels I've ever read. Actually, a collection of four horror novellas.
Yeah.
Really good stuff. I'll loan you that, Greg. but a lot of the books on the list were out of print and difficult to obtain.
Right.
And Cows was a shining example of that. When I read the premise, I was like, oh man, I've got to read this book. And the only copies I could find were selling on eBay for like $150 for a paperback.
Yeah.
It had only been out of print since the late 90s, but it apparently had a very, very small print run. And so I looked for it off and on for years and eventually more or less gave up until I got a Kindle.
Mm.
And lo and behold, it is available in the Kindle Marketplace, and I believe it is back in print.
Oh, really?
So if you want to read this book, because I think it's probably safe to say you haven't read it yet. It's fairly
if you're listening.
But if you'd like to read it, it is fairly easy to obtain now.
Yeah, so yeah.
So going into it, we'll talk about our expectations going in. Based on what people were saying about the book, the reviews I had found online, I expected it to be incredibly disgusting.
Right.
And based on its inclusion on the 50 Great Alternative Horror Novels list, I expected it to be very frightening.
Right.
I did not find it to be a very frightening book. Mm-hmm. At least not in the traditional sense.
Right.
Like
spooky. Yeah, something jumping out of a corner and frightening you. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Suspense.
It's not frightening in that way. It is frightening in a man's inhumanity to man sort of way.
Yeah, the Heart of Darkness kind of thing.
Yeah. But my expectations regarding disturbing violence, those were not disappointed at all.
No.
I guess we'll talk shortly about, what the book is actually about. First, Greg, what were your expectations going in?
I didn't actually have a whole lot of expectations. You had recommended it to me, and you mentioned it in the same breath as another book that we'll be probably talking about, called Hog.
Yes.
And had said that it was along the same lines. And Hog had already become sort of a byword in our friendship for things that were terrible.
Yeah.
Like, oh man, the pizza place, it's like Hog all over again. You know, I mean, you know to stay away from the pepperoni. Yeah. I was not really going into it thinking anything in particular. I will say that the title disturbed me. Cows. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the thing, and I'll go off on a little bit of a rant here. Please. Cows freak me out. I find them, you know, sort of placid and beautiful in a certain way. I mean, you know, I appreciate the whole ox-eyed Hera from the Homer's works and all that sort of stuff. You know, I get it. I understand what he's getting at. But
I'm glad you do. I'm not sure what you're talking about, but please, go on.
There is a terrifying stupidity in cows. A bovine self-satisfaction, you know, sort of like wallowing in their own crap kind of thing, and you know, they're vomiting up their own food and eating it over and over and over again. Just that sort of plodding, it reminds me of an unsettling mass that is stupid but somehow insurmountable.
It's I think if you are not from the country and have not been exposed to cows, you maybe don't realize, anybody who spends time around cows knows that they're pretty disgusting.
Yeah, they're foul.
They're just, you can smell them from a mile away. I used to drive, while I was working as a security guard at the dam, I would drive past a dairy farm routinely.
Mm.
That was, time to roll up the windows.
Yeah.
Always covered in flies.
Yeah.
And mucus.
Yeah.
Well, mucus. They're pretty disgusting. I guess, I didn't know that you had this feeling about them since you live a stone's throw from cows now.
Well, I do now, yeah. And I also, over the past year, I was living pretty close to a dairy farm. And, I'd go out and run, and I'd be really, hitting my wind sprints and everything. I get a nice lung full of cow ass and just kind of took the wind out of my sails.
Yeah.
I remember in particular, this, again, just explaining the background, I remember driving past a field of cows with my grandfather, my late grandfather, and he was not ordinarily an emotional man or a man who told us about his proclivities or interests or who he was. I remember him driving past and then looking over and going, cows, I just wish I'd killed more of them. He found them to be
in the war.
Yeah, exactly. He was talking about Italy. He's talking about Germany and Italy and how cows had gotten in his way constantly, and that they needed to move them off, and an Italian peasant would have a bunch of cows and they'd just be this huge pain in the ass. And it'd be like, oh man, come on, get the cow out of the way. Oh damn it, why can't we just shoot this stupid beast? So I know that they're a cutesy thing and people make magnets and, oh, everybody loves cows, but up close, it's a little gruesome.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'll tell you a little bit about this book, what it's about here. So Cows is a novel, it's about a young man named Stephen who lives with his grotesque mother. Horrifyingly grotesque mother in a disgusting apartment with his crippled dog.
Named Dog.
He takes a job at a slaughterhouse where he is sort of taught the art of killing cows and people and pretty much anything.
Yeah.
By Cripps, who is the incredibly violent foreman at the slaughterhouse. And where the book takes a hard left turn into weirdness is that there's a pack of talking cows that live in the sewers beneath the slaughterhouse.
Yeah.
And sort of range throughout the city. And they ask Stephen to kill Cripps. And he sort of becomes a vengeful mentor.
Kind of like a cow messiah, really.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually got some parallels with, now I won't be able to, El Topo, by the film by Alejandro Jodorowsky.
Mm-hmm.
Probably mispronouncing that horribly. Anyway, and also there's a profoundly disturbing subplot with his girlfriend, Lucy.
Who lives up the stair from him. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, and, you know, I would contest slightly your assertion that the film the book gets weird when the cows start talking.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's been weird. It gets weird in an exciting new way when the cows begin to talk.
Yeah, it's a big plot twist, put it that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's, I mean, we should advise you that if you are coming to this thinking like, oh, Ben and Greg don't like Twilight, well, that must mean you're recommending something high literary. No, I mean, it has great literary qualities. It is a alarmingly compulsive read.
Yes.
I read most of it in a day. Mm-hmm. But it is also stomach-turning and nauseating at times. We mean that literally.
Yes. It is... It is a disgusting, vile book, and it's one of maybe, certainly no more than 5 books I have read that have nearly caused me to pass out.
Yeah.
I have a handful of books I've read where I'll be sitting there reading, and I'll get to a pretty rough part and feel like the tunnel vision, just the, you know, I just lose my peripheral vision, and things start to get fuzzy.
Yeah.
And I've never had a book actually make me pass out, but it's one of those that brought me to the brink.
Well, I think the thing about cows, I mean, I think that when people hear like, oh, well, you know, cows is really gross, it's disgusting, what they're going to think is that it's describing something gross.
Mm.
So, like, the fact of what it's talking about is gross. That's true.
Yes.
There's a lot of really gross stuff that happens. But the thing that makes it stomach-turning is the vivid quality of the writing.
Yes.
The fact that it's not just, like, mechanically describing some weird deviant sex thing or like mutilation or stuff like that. It is describing it in such a vivid way that you are completely contained within the scene. And Cows was actually a book, you know, the day that I read Cows, actually, I was completely alone out here most of the day and chopping down this tree. So, you know, there were a lot of times I'd be reading it and I'd look up and it was sort of this weird shock of recognition. Like, oh, I'm still in this world. Like it's very immersive, it's very much a coherent world, but it is also a very frightening and terrifying world in some ways. Yes.
Yeah, it's... well, yeah, you mentioned Hogg.
Yeah.
And I guess now is as good a time as any to explain briefly about Hogg.
Yeah.
Hogg is a book by a guy named Samuel R. Delaney. He's written other much more popular books.
Well, not just popular, but like he's one of the sort of the new wave of sci-fi writers in the 70s who wrote like more mythical or literary quality sci-fi stuff.
Yeah, Dahlgren, I believe, was Dahlgren. One of his big books, which I've been looking for a copy for a while. I've not been able to find one. Hogg was a book he wrote in 68.
Yeah.
That is about a young boy who falls in with a group of murderous pedophile rapists.
Yeah.
There's no act too grotesque for them. They do just horrible things, and they travel across the country. They're all disgusting. And it is... there isn't a page of the book that isn't unsettling. I mean, it's got... Yeah. There's not a taboo that isn't broken.
Yeah.
And it is a book, I think, that has some literary merit. At some point later in the podcast, if we have time, I may have to discuss the environment in which I read Hawk. Pretty good story in and of itself.
Yeah.
But it's another one of these books, sort of like Cows, that I was drawn to it initially because it's so extreme.
Right, yeah.
And you hear something about me that when I hear that, like, man, this is the most fucked up book you're ever going to read.
Right.
Well, bring it on. I got to find out. What surprised me with Cows was that while there isn't as much, well, I mean, nothing can match Hogg as far as the sheer quantity of gruesome and horrible stuff happening. I think that Cows, admittedly it's been a while since I've read Hogg, but I think that Cows is much more vivid.
Yeah.
And the things that are described are more lovingly described.
Yeah.
In a way that makes it almost worse. Because you can place yourself there.
Well, I think that in Hogg there was at times a kind of 9-year-old boy glee in shoving something unpleasant in your face.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, you know, like, oh, here's a snake, little girl. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Cows is, like, the disgusting things in Cows are very much an element in a literary creation.
Yes.
This is not random sort of provocation spewed off this mm-hmm. train of hell that's rocketing through your mind. Mm-hmm. It's, in fact, a world that you're peeking into.
Yeah. I think Hogg has a more anarchic sensibility.
Yeah.
And Cows, the violence is there. It all builds to a point.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
It is, you know, it means something.
Yeah.
In Hogg, if anything, it means that it has no meaning.
Right. Well, that's actually something I was going to talk about and ask you about, what you thought. Because both of the protagonists of these books are kind of shapeless initially. Like, that's the catch. You know, they're kind of Kafka-esque sort of people that sort of blunder into situations and with varying degrees adapt themselves to it. Now, Cows is about a guy who has no personality trying to become somebody that has a personality. Hmm. And Hogg is more or less about somebody who enjoys the experience of being with Hogg because he can destroy what remnants of his personality there were. He can get lost in this degradation. He can get lost in, you know, sucking the scum off of Hogg's toe or, you know, things like that, like really degrading stuff, because doing that stuff is a way of forgetting himself.
Yeah. I think that's true. In Cows, there's a lot of repetition of the idea of being like the people on TV.
Yeah.
There's this almost religious fascination with sitcoms.
Yeah.
And, you know, trying to escape your horrible life by transforming your life into this thing that doesn't really exist.
Right.
But Stephen hopes it exists.
You know, right.
He thinks it is possible up until the end.
Right. Well, I think that the difference is that, you know, when I would watch, when I was a kid and then when I started to grow up, when I would watch like a John Waters movie or like a Tim Burton movie, there was like a parody of like a postmodern kind of parody of like TV life that was very current in the 80s. Like think like Edward Scissorhands, Domesticity, like that kind of thing where everything was plastic and fake. Mm-hmm. And it never struck me as real because there was never anything appealing about it that would make me want to be that. But the whole premise is like, oh, well, everybody just wants to be plastic. It's like, well, why? That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
It seemed too forced. It seemed to have like too much snide sneering at people who were more acceptable. I think that the difference is in Cows that it's convincing that this guy would want to escape from the clutches of his awful, disgusting mother and become powerful by leading the talking cows. And also become, like, ensconced with a wife and an apartment and a child and all this stuff. Like, it's not just, I mean, it is an imitating TV. Mm-hmm. Like, that's, but I think the point is not so much that he is obsessed with TV, but that TV is the only way that he sees these people. He's so surrounded by disgusting, awful people that he never sees anybody normal. Yeah. So the only way he ever sees it, it's almost like a National Geographic thing. You know, like, he's the tribesman watching people, you know, like, off in Never Neverland.
Yeah. Huh. I could see that.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that, well, I mean, I guess just as a side note, it's kind of funny that, you know, cows and hog, you know, they're both have barnyard animals, which probably says something more about our current remove from, you know, domesticated animals. Yeah. Than it has to do with anything else. But, yeah, what'd you make of the whole, like, triumph of the will kind of element in cows?
Well, there's one scene in particular. The thing with this book is it is a funny book.
Yeah.
At times.
It is.
Very funny. But it's funny in a sickening way.
Yeah.
Sort of that, you know, John Waters, Pink Flamingos kind of funny.
Yeah.
And there's this great sequence. So Stephen and his mother, again, you know, there are times when it's like, I don't know how much detail we want to go into in describing this stuff because it is so heinous.
Yeah.
But there, Stephen's mother, his disgusting, horrible mother, cooks for him. Like, every meal, she cooks for him. And she apparently just prepares horrible things. You know, everything is undercooked.
Or rotten.
Or rotten.
Yeah.
Or just going to poison him.
Right.
And he's convinced she's trying to kill him. And
right.
She probably is. So he decides, you know, well, from now on, he kind of stands up for himself. You know, from now on, I'm cooking.
Right.
I'm cooking for the both of us. And he's going to try to kill her before she can kill him. So the very first night, he just shits on a couple plates.
Yeah.
And, which as Stoko describes in very loving detail, because Stephen has such a horrible diet, the caliber of his scat is quite repulsive.
More so than usual.
Yeah. Not at all healthy. And so there's this really, I mean, stomach-turning but genuinely funny moment where Stephen and his mother are sitting at opposite ends of the dinner table, just sort of the battle of the wills, just, you know, well, I'll eat this shit if you do. You
yeah.
know? And, of course, they do. Yeah, it's... It is amusing, and that continues into the slaughterhouse.
Where, right.
He is going to reform his life by forcing himself to do these distasteful things. It's almost almost got a Hemingway kind of quality. Hemingway and John Waters had a kid, you know?
Yeah, well, it's the thing that surprised me, actually... And, I mean, this is another obscure book, and you have my copy of this, actually. There's a book called The Hundred Brothers by Donald Antrim, and that's about a group of 100 brothers, mysteriously, who gather together in their father's house, and they have, like, this really, really weird set of rites that they go through, and it culminates in a sacrifice and stuff. And that there are a lot of weird mythic initiation rite things that happen in this book. There's, you know, the whole premise of Cripps's initiation of Stephen into, you know, the slaughterhouse is that killing a cow teaches you how to be a man.
Yes.
And that we have taken cows out of the farmland. We've taken them away from their grassland, and now we make them in the city. You know, we grow cows, basically, like a plant. But the gift that the cows have given back to us is the knowledge of what it means to take a life. And so there's all this very epic, heroic struggle stuff about, like, killing the cows and entering into, actually, like, a homosexual fraternity of murderers.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's really gruesome in a lot of ways, and I think it is intended in some ways just to gross you out. But, you know, having, like, read a lot of anthropology stuff, like, it actually shares a lot in common with old, really old, like, initiation rites that the Australian Aborigines would do and things like that. Or even, you know, for that matter, the ancient Greeks.
Well, and for that matter, I mean, I watched the 700 Club. I know that there is a fraternal order of homosexual murderers trying to warp our children's brains.
It's only a matter of time.
Something must be done.
But yeah, there's very definitely a self-actualization dimension, because the whole thing is about Steven like trying to find himself in a discipline, in the discipline of conquering his fears and that whole thing. There was one thing in particular that I liked, a quote. This is a little bit unfair because, Ben, you do not have your electronic copy.
Yeah. Nor did I take any notes. So if you think the previous episodes, you know, have a disjointed quality.
So he's got this cow friend that talks to him in addition to his other cow friends. And so the cow is a Guernsey cow. So the Guernsey was speaking from a different world, and its words meant nothing. They were for somebody else, not the self-contained god who left them behind as so much noise and strode through the twilight along city roads that glittered with the phosphorescence of recognition. He knew these streets, had pursued them through dreaming hag-beast nights, had plotted and examined each stone and dollop of tar that supported the TV lies of all the people who trod them. Tonight they opened effortlessly for him, empty and softly glowing, leading straight to his flat. So as you get, I mean, like, for one thing, that's very great writing.
Yes.
Like, that is compulsively readable stuff. It's great. But the thing that I would point out is, you know, him referring to himself as a self-contained god. You know, that he had already sort of thought of himself as an autonomous, and that he's just sort of blazing a path through the world. So it sort of goes from the first half of the book, him being persecuted, to the second half of the book, to him becoming the persecutor.
Yeah, well, and there's the theories, well, not theory, but the mindset that Cripps instills in him it's very similar to something you already hear, which is, you know, you hear people all the time say, like, if somebody's giving a hunter a hard time, they'll say, like, well, I mean, you eat meat too, I just have the stones to go out and kill it myself.
Right.
And that in some way makes you, enlarges your understanding of the world. And this would be taking that to a severe extreme.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's sort of a double-edged thing, though. You know, recently, Paul Fussell, the guy who wrote a lot about the world wars and stuff,
yeah.
Very, very much anti-war, but nonetheless felt in the context of war, like, well, if they're my enemy, kill them dead. Kill them. And there was this contradiction that emerged where, although he hated war, he also wrote his entire life about the special knowledge that you get from having people shoot at you and from shooting at people. And I think that part of the fascination of this kind of book is that kind of experience of things that are beyond the verge of what you experience day to day. And they're horrifying. They might twist you and they might corrupt you and you might not ever come back. But if you go there, you will learn things that you will never be able to learn in your life, in your day to day life. I think that's part of the reason why we're drawn to it.
Yeah. I think that's very true. That was actually tying into part of the larger discussion
right.
I want to have about, you know, what is the value. Like I said, you know, often find myself drawn towards, you know, the extreme sorts of books.
Right.
You know, this, Hog, Crash by Ballard would be another good one. Have you read that book?
I still haven't read it, no.
It's strange stuff. but, you know, I think that one reason people are drawn to that, like, you know, there's a great example going on right now is, and this is very unique to this time in our nation's history, but just recently there was that case in Florida where the guy on the bath salt drugs ate a homeless guy's face.
Right.
Which is horrible. And it's just very, it's no good. It's distasteful. It's something you've...
Take that to the bank, folks. We don't approve of cannibalism.
Taking a hardline stance here. It's something you would think, yeah, most people would be like, oh, I won't hear about that.
Right.
But it's all anybody's talking about.
Right.
Because I think we are so insulated, particularly in this country, from horrible realities of the world that when we have an opportunity to experience that from a safe remove in a way that doesn't affect us, but we can sort of glimpse, you know, behind the veil, that it's a very enticing thing. It's sort of like, you know, I've heard it argued, well, the reason that people like horror movies is you get to experience that in a safe, you know, experience terror in a safe context.
Right.
Which is something that we have some sort of biological need to do.
Right. Well, I mean, I've heard that before. I think that, I guess I would differ that I don't know how much of reality it is that we are avoiding that would include, like, routine cannibalism. I mean, you know, like, I think that, you know, the thing is that when was the greatest boom for mainstream horror movies? Well, the 1930s. Yeah. Everything was horrible in the 1930s. Yeah. Things were terrible. Mm-hmm. But people loved it.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, actually, I've been rereading a book by Kenneth Clark, which I made a reference to in the Da Vinci Code podcast. But a book by Kenneth Clark called The Nude, and he's talking about different evolutions of the way that the nude has been depicted throughout history from the Greeks to the present day. And he's talking about how in the 19th century, you know, at the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries, there was this artist who went from painting very light and elegant, almost sexless girls, and then all of a sudden began painting fat, stentorian, almost lizard-shaped women that he only labeled prostitutes. And I read this last night, and I remember thinking that it was very relevant to what we'd be talking about, that Kenneth Clark says that in the materialistic and lukewarm society that this artist lived in, you know, France at the turn of the century, that degradation almost came to look like redemption. And I think there is that kind of through the looking glass quality of, you know, like, well, what will I find here? That when things are not so much, like, good, I mean, I don't think that the average American walks around just, like, on a pile of clouds. Mm-hmm. I think it's more just that the daily American life is pretty anodyne. It's just sort of like, well, you drift from one thing to another, and you know, you hear bad news, and yeah, bad things happen, but there's not a sense of perhaps physical struggle. Yeah. Frequently. So that when you do hear about that kind of thing, you sense like, oh, this is where real life is happening, and I'm just like, you know, I'm a fake. And it was kind of interesting reading about that in Cows, where the guy is so focused on, you know, how he wants to be one of these fake people, you know.
Yeah. Man, it's I don't really have anything to say to that, Greg. I mean, yeah, all right. Yeah. I'll buy cool that for
stuff.
$1.
Cool stuff, yeah. Man. Cool.
Well, I mean, well, you know, I think, too, though, we have, particularly with death, you know, I think we have a very weird attitude towards death in this country, where, like, I've actually seen at funerals, yeah, we have the tradition of throwing a clod of earth onto the casket, right?
I've never done that.
I have not myself, but I have been to a funeral where rather than just having to, like, actually pick up a clod of dirt, you had a special thing that looked like a giant salt shaker, and that was filled with earth, and you would hold that to shake it onto the grave.
Yeah.
And it seemed like just one more level. You know, so much of the modern funeral process is attempting to distance you from the fact that, you know, hey, we're shoving a body in the earth. You know,
yeah.
You don't want to acknowledge that. I think that's part of the reason that, yeah, I mean, like, CSI.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all 17 of the CSI shows. those are hugely popular.
Right.
I think part of it is that, you know, it is a safe way to examine and acknowledge death.
Well, it's with the, it is at the side of people who will always know more than you do. You know, it doesn't matter how well-versed you are in forensics or anything like that. You will still watch CSI and they'll pull out something you don't know. And that's the point, is, you know, it's a TV show. It's a limitless store of stuff. I mean, they just go online, look it up.
Yeah.
But I think that that's sort of like, this guy knows way more. And also, that the most popular shows are about death, right? Mm-hmm. But the most popular shows about death are always formulaic.
Yes.
The whole thing is always a procedural. It's always like, well, we begin with death, we begin with trouble, and then we end by tying it up. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the, there's a great book by Friedrich Dürrenmatt, which I'll throw that one out there, too.
Oh, of course, that guy.
Yeah. The Pledge is made into a movie with Jack Nicholson. Yeah.
I am familiar with that, actually.
I haven't seen the movie. I read the book. I cannot believe this guy is not better known, because this was a great, great crime book. And I'm not like a big crime book guy, but I really like this. But it's all about this guy investigating this horrible, savage murder. And what he starts to discover is that there might not be an answer. And he kind of knows, but he kind of doesn't know. And that kind of feeling of, well, you know, maybe everything will not be knit together in the end is, I think, pretty scary. And I think people don't really, you know, it's the anti-CSI.
Yeah.
And I think that's what more people tend to feel at a funeral. You know, I mean, that's why you look around other people. That's why you want to talk about memories and stuff. You want to gather up the person that you've lost in a way that is not gathering them up to throw them away. Death in particular is one of those things. But what do you think the you know, we've sort of beat around the bush of what the the value of reading these books is. What do you got anything there?
Well,
is there a value?
I think there is. I mean, one thing that is often frustrating to me is that I think for a lot of people, if you were to tell them, you know, oh, I just read this book, Cows, it's one of the most disgusting books I've ever read, what they will hear is, it's one of the worst books I've ever read.
Right.
They will hear, you know, people tend to equate, you know, if it's violent or repulsive, well, it's bad. It's
right.
Just no good. And you hear that a lot, you know, with a lot of genres. But I think that, you know, this is a book that has fairly indisputable literary merit.
Yeah.
And I think that it is not so much a violent book as it is a book about violence.
Hmm.
I think that the overall takeaway from it could definitely be argued. But when I read it, I saw sort of Stoko writing about violence as almost an infection.
Hmm.
And that in Stephen, because of his horrible home life, this lunatic he encountered at the slaughterhouse, he sort of becomes infected with this into this violent world.
Right.
Which he then passes on to the cows, and by the end of the book, he has become the leader of the cows, like the actual leader. He kills the, not to spoil it, but he kills the Guernsey, and he becomes their true leader, and in that sense he, by the end of the book, transforms from a man into an animal.
Right.
And what that also speaks to, which I think is a misconception.
Okay, all right.
What is a misconception with books like this is I think a lot of people think, oh, well, yeah, this guy wrote this grotesquely violent book. He must be getting off on this.
Right.
And I think that's usually not the case. It's like when people say, oh, isn't it ironic that Alfred Hitchcock made all those scary movies when he himself was scared of everything? Well, no, it's not ironic at all. He did that because he was scared of everything.
Yeah.
He did it as a way of coping with that.
Right.
And I think, you know, I would be willing to bet, I've never met the guy, he could be deranged, but I'd be willing to bet that Matthew Stoko finds the things in this book as reprehensible as anyone.
Yeah.
And that he's writing to cope with those things.
Right. Well, I would say that one of the things that struck me about Cows is that, and you may disagree with me on this, you know, beyond the talking cows thing, which is a bit of a leap, you know, I'll give you that. Given all the horrible things that you hear about, and also given the emotional tenor of things that I've seen and or experienced in my life, I didn't find Cows to be necessarily unbelievable.
Yeah.
I didn't really, like, look at this and just go like, oh, man, well, this would never happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, yeah, it would never happen in a concrete sense, maybe. But the emotional quality of the battle between father, or between child and parent, you know, mm-hmm. son and mother, of the struggle to establish a normal life with another deranged person, the weird initiatory dance that you do with anybody who's your mentor that can be quite aggressive and violent. It was like he was taking, like, as though like life had started the sentence and he finished it with a paragraph. He took sort of things to a very surreal and dark place, but to a place that I think is unfortunately on a continuum with some things that are in the human psyche.
Yeah, I would agree with that to a point. I mean, it's reminds me of the introduction to Kurt Vonnegut's book Slapstick, which actually, you know, not to enrage the internet, but I think the introduction to that book may be better than the book itself. But Kurt Vonnegut has a pretty amazing quote that's really stuck with me about how the book was as close as he would ever get to an autobiography because it was about how life felt to him. And then, you know, this proceeds to be a book about gigantic twins who have telekinetic powers or something. It's kind of fuzzy. It's been a while since I've read it. But as you read it, if you know anything about Vonnegut, you can say, oh, yeah, it's probably how life feels to Vonnegut. You know?
Right.
It was also about his relationship with his sister. But I think that Cowes is the same way. I have no doubt, unfortunately, that there are a lot of people in the world who would read this book and say, oh, yeah, that's how life feels to me.
Right.
That's right on the money.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that, you know, talking about the whole self-contained God thing, because he goes from the very depths of self-abnegation and self-hatred and And in the process of changing into this guy who's extremely self-confident, there are moments in the book where he talks about how he knows that the thing that he is doing, whether it's killing a cow or killing a person or weird deviant stuff, he knows that he is killing off parts of his soul that he wishes he could preserve.
Yeah.
He feels the good remnants of himself dying. And actually, I'll draw another book I've been reading lately. I recently reread Marilynne Robinson's Housekeeping. And it's all about the line kind of between, like, people who live in a house, people who live in, like, a domestic set of expectations, and people who are vagrants, rail riders, people who don't really know how to keep a house. You know, their houses are filled with leaves and animals and stuff like that. And there's one point where she's talking about what it feels like, you know, to look outside of your house, you know, like when you look in the mirror on a dark, or you look in the window on a dark night, and you see yourself projected out into the darkness, versus when you're standing outside an illuminated house, and you see yourself projected, you know, in the reflection of the window into the house. And she said that, you know, or the narrator says that she wonders if all people that wander, that all people that are, you know, metaphorically outside the house, don't in some way wish that they could come into the house and tear it to pieces. And I think that there is something to that. I think that there is something to that. You know, I've met people like that. I've met wandering people, people who, whether or not they have a house, whether or not they have a bank account, they are lost. Mm-hmm. And while you may feel bad for them and while you may want to help them, they are at times very dangerous to be around. Because they don't trust things that would shelter them and protect them. And they will tear down the house. And I think that that, in some ways, is what happens with the protagonist of Cowes, where the more power he gets, the more control he gets, he can only see it in destructive ways. Even the sacraments that he starts to give the cows, you know, literally tells the cows, you know, come forward and be blessed, and has them eat human flesh. Which, in a way, is very, you know, a parody of basically the Eucharist.
Absolutely.
It becomes this weird thing where the only way he can achieve like selfhood or transcendence is by destroying everything. Mm. Yeah, some men just want to watch the world burn thing. So,
And there are, and it's been admittedly, it's been a couple weeks since I read this book, and at the time I read it, it had not crossed my mind that we'd do a podcast about it. But aren't there times in the book where he acknowledges the fact that the way that he is leading the cows, which is through horrible violence committed against innocent people, he acknowledges the fact that this is not the way to do it.
Right.
But because he is an outsider and because he wants their respect, it's the only thing that he can do.
Right.
And he, you know, it is interesting that he acknowledges from time to time that what he is doing is wrong.
Yeah.
But he is compelled to continue doing it.
Right. Well, it sort of reminded me of the, for instance, I think one of the things you might be talking about is the Guernsey comes up with this really elaborate plan for, like, a cow attack on some human place. And, like, remember that? Like, where he has, like, all the separate stages for what the cows are going to do? And then the protagonist, Steven, just walks in and is like, screw it. Let's just do it.
Yeah.
And he knows that that will be way more exciting for the cows than anything else. And it kind of reminded me, I can't remember where I read this, and actually there's a pretty good book about this called Rites of Spring, about, you know, the fascination with degradation that occupies modern art from the early 20th century and how that ties into fascism and things like that. But there was a quote from somebody that said that, you know, everybody thinks that what the Nazis did was they imposed order, and that, oh man, people just wanted law and order, and that's the trick. That's the reason why, you know, the people wanted somebody to walk in and say no. And that what in fact was happening was that the Nazis gave you permission to do basically whatever you wanted. If you were a Nazi, well, all right, you can do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to stop you. That frequently when people tell you that they are law and order, and that when they are, you know, just saying no after all these years of willy-nilly saying yes, in fact what they are doing is giving themselves permission to be savage.
Yeah, some of the most disturbing psychological experiments I have ever read about are the ones where consequence is removed from the equation.
Mm.
Like the experiments about, you know, putting a bunch of people in a room, then turning the lights off, and suddenly everyone's getting groped. or you know, Zimbardo's Stanford Prison Experiment.
Right.
You know, where anytime consequence is removed from the human equation, very unsettling things happen that you don't want to admit would be possible to happen.
Right.
And that's basically what Stephen does for the cows.
Right.
Yeah. So that's no good. quite bad indeed.
So, I don't know how far along we are, but would you, I guess the next question is, you know, who would you recommend this to and why?
Yeah, well, I...
or either of these books, I guess.
Yeah.
Because they're kind of two different recommendations.
Oh, Cows and Hogs?
Yeah. Yeah.
Boy, the difficult thing is that, you know, you have to acknowledge the fact that a lot of people will be very turned off by either of these books.
Yeah.
And that's okay. You know, if you, all art is not for everyone.
Right.
And if you think that, if you hear us describing two books, by saying that they are so disgusting that they made me nearly pass out, and you are still interested, then I would definitely recommend Cows. I think that Cows, I would say Cows has more literary merit than Hog. Again,
yeah.
Cows has a point.
Right.
It has. It you can debate it with a friend on your podcast. Hog is interesting as an artifact, and it is interesting because of its excess. It is interesting because Samuel R. Delaney submitted it to the same publisher that had published the works of the Marquis de Sade, and that publisher rejected it solely on the basis of its sexual content, which is a mean feat. You know, if... based on those qualifications, if you were interested, I would say go for it.
Yeah.
It, may taint your soul, but
yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing, is that the reading experience in some ways, I think this is why Cows is a little bit unusual, because it's not really true. But the reading experience kind of mirrors the protagonist's experience. So, you know, in Hog, like, the character goes from basically, like, stumbling in on these horrible things happening, and by the end, he's complicit. By the end, he's actually, like, taking part in the activities. And with a reader, you know, you stumble into Hog, you're like, oh, what? I don't know who does this, but let's just say that you picked it up on a bookstall.
Yeah.
And, you know, by the end of it, like, you are wrapped up in what's going on. Like, you are in some way complicit in what's being told in the story. I do think Hog is kind of a stunt. Like you said, it's anarchic. It doesn't really have a direction. It's just sort of spazzing off, shooting off various excrescences of disgust. But there's a great deal of very beautiful control at work in Cows. And actually, it sort of reminded me of, you know, you read about, like, the modernists and even some of the writers in the 1890s reading, like, really, really decadent, disgusting stuff by, you know, like, Against Nature and, you know, things like that. And everybody's always confused by that. They're always like, you know, oh, why would these people who write, you know, these foundational, beautiful, elaborate works about the human condition, why would they be interested in, you know, degraded perversion? And I think it's for that reason that it's pretty easy to get away with writing a quote-unquote scary book by just playing on a few keys over and over again. You know, that's one of the reasons why writers might want to read this.
Yes.
Is that you have to control very carefully how you work someone's disgust. And you have to work on the scale of it. And you have to figure out, like, all right, well, how far have I gone so far that they will not accept this, or that they won't be grossed out by that? Like, it takes a great deal of control. And it also takes a great deal of control to keep people reading something like this.
Yes. Which is one thing, again, that's very impressive with Cows, is that, I mean, I read it in two sittings.
Right.
It's not a incredibly long book, but it is a very compulsive read.
Yeah.
I will say, too, in this same vein, I think one of the values of books like this, these gruesome works, is that it's very rare for me to read a popular book that really challenges me, that really surprises me. Now, admittedly, with something like Hog, it's a very cheap kind of surprise. It's a cheap reaction.
Yeah.
But with the, you know, the previous books we have read for this podcast, there was nothing that really caused me, well, maybe back for Steve Harvey, that caused me a pretty strong reaction. But it's not as common to get that kind of reaction.
Right.
And I've always felt like, with my own writing, I'd rather have someone say, oh, God, I hate this, than have them say, oh, yeah, that was, you know,
it's okay. Yeah.
Like, no, you want something. You want something to happen. You know, right. Even a very strong negative reaction is better than no reaction. So, if you are feeling bored with what you've been reading, this'll put a spark in your pants. You know, yeah,
at the very least, send you running back to whatever you were reading before. Well, I guess you got anything else, or we probably tie up our first special episode?
Yeah, well, I guess I will say that this is something we would certainly like to do more of in the future.
Yeah.
If you would like to email us at canonfodderpod, CanonFodderPod, at gmail.com, just send us an email and, you know, give us something to question you'd like to hear us talk about.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll do a special episode that's a mailbag episode.
Yeah.
For example, you could ask me to tell the tantalizing story of my experience reading Hog, which I alluded to, but did not tell.
Well, that's an Easter egg. You know, that'll be on the complete collection.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, just send us a note. I mean, we're very lonely.
Yes.
And we appreciate any correspondence. You could send us one of those e-cards.
Yeah.
You know, it's animated, tells us to have a super day or something like that with puppies.
Yeah.
Or cows, for that matter.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, just anything you want answered, anything you want us to talk about, weird topics. And of course, always book suggestions are eagerly accepted.
Yes.
And we may not get around to it immediately, but God knows we're looking at it. Yeah. So we will see it and we will address it at some point.
Guys, we haven't gotten a single goddamn email. All right, I'm sorry.
You're falling down the job. Yeah, I'm sick of this crap. Yeah. Let's get down to brass tacks.
I realize it's still the soft launch, not on iTunes yet. I'm working on that. It's very confusing. You have to learn XML. I don't know what the hell XML is. But I think it's that football league that was really short-lived.
Big, medium, large, you know.
Yeah. So, send us an email. Follow us on Twitter. I am at Ben R. Williams.
I was at Old Jawbone, but now that I live out in the wilderness, I'm nothing.
Yeah, I guess Greg's not doing the Twitter too much. You can get in touch with me. I still go a town sometimes. I'd like to thank Mr. Ryan Browning, as always, for the use of his song Destroyer, our theme song.
Yeah.
Go to sewntogetherrecords.com. I believe that they have by now probably met their Kickstarter goal, but that does not mean that you cannot continue donating money, and you should. In fact, I believe if you want the special edition of the physical release they're putting out, that Kickstarter donations are the only way to get it.
Mm.
And you want that.
So, you want it bad.
Yeah.
You don't even know it.
So, yeah, thanks so much for listening to us. I know this one wasn't as funny, but, you know, hopefully it was educational.
Yeah.
And next week, we'll be back talking about 50 Shades of Grey, which will be funny because it's awful.
Yeah. Get ready for some lady porn, guys.
Yeah.
Coming in.
All right. Well, good night, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Good night, everyone.